Dr. Mills's lecture today is titled Theorizing Racial Justice. Please help me welcome the 2020 Tanner Lecturer on Human Values, Dr. Charles W. Mills.
Well, thank you so much to the organizers for this invitation. It was mentioned that my first reason was in physics, and then I switched to philosophy. The real reason was that in physics, you do actual experiments, and I found that they never came out the way I wanted, so you constantly have to fudge them. But the great virtue of philosophy is that you had to do thought experiments, and you then have complete control of the outcome. So now this was clearly the kind of discipline I had been waiting for. The physics thing was a big mistake. So in all seriousness, when I got this invitation, I was flattered, I felt honored, but I was also shocked because I thought of myself, you know, we like to sort of position ourselves with various delusions. I thought of myself as this radical oppositional guy, and I said, you know, radical oppositional guys don't give the Tanner lectures. I mean, you know, that's something that's like a blot on your CV, so maybe I'll have to think this over. And then they mentioned the honorarium, and I said, well, okay, I guess I'll have to sort of... I'll have to give up my principles just this once. And in all seriousness, it is a real honor. It's wonderful to be here. Some of you may remember Clint Eastwood at the Academy Awards a few years ago talking to the absent figure of Barack Obama in a chair. As you just heard, John Rawls gave a lecture in this place some years ago. So perhaps on occasion you might find, is there an empty chair? There's that one there. You might find me turning around to address him from time to time. Okay, guys, so there's a detailed handout here, which you're really going to need in part because there are, you know, diagrams and so maybe that's part of my physics heritage. You know, they always told us, draw a diagram. So it'll help you to make sense of the whole thing. I'm going to talk for about 70 minutes, so the talk itself is longer than that, but I'll skip about a bit. But as I say, with the handout, you ought to be able to follow along. Okay, so my lecture this evening seeks to address the issue of racial justice and in the process to look also at the question of why the subject has been so little addressed in Western and more specifically American political philosophy. For it is not as if the demand for racial justice is a new one. The protests of recent years, above all Black Lives Matter, have brought the topic solidly back onto the national agenda, effectively shattering the widespread post-racial society illusions that Barack Obama's 2008 election had encouraged. But of course, the demand is much older. One would go back to the earlier civil rights movements of the 1950s and 60s, both mainstream and radical, or before that, to the debates around post-bellum Reconstruction and the later disappointment and anger over the betrayal of Reconstruction, or before that, during the epoch of slavery, to the long history of antebellum abolitionism. And this list just focuses on blacks. I've not even said anything about Japanese internment, Chinese exclusion, anti-Latinx discrimination, or returning to the founding colonial encounters, Native American expropriation and genocide. So the outcry against the inequitable treatment of people of color by whites, if not always under the explicit ban of racial justice, has in a sense always constituted the discordant counterpoint, the dissonantly off-key chorus to what could be thought of as a self-congratulatory soundtrack, the approved theme music and national anthems, official and unofficial of the Republic, a Republic that was, after all, effectively founded as, in a famous quote, a white man's country. And yet, despite, or should that be because of, this history and the larger history of modern Western imperialism and conquest in which it is embedded, white American political philosophers in particular, and white Western political philosophers more generally, have almost completely ignored the subject. But philosophers, at least in their own minds, are supposedly the professional experts, the go-to guys on questions of justice, stretching back 2,500 years to ancient Athens, and the book often seen as the foundational text of the tradition, Plato's Republic. Moreover, the Western philosopher widely credited with reviving Anglo-American political philosophy which had been judged by moribund at the time, was himself an American citizen, John Rawls. His famous 1971 book, A Theory of Justice, is standardly regarded not merely as reorienting the normative focus of the subdiscipline from the issue of a political obligation to the state to the issue of the justice of society's basic structure, but as making grand theory in the field possible again, as against boring logic chopping and linguistic analysis. Surely then, the ideal conceptual and theoretical environment had now been created to talk about issues of racial justice, especially in the wake of 1960s protests and global post-war decolonization. Yet as emphasized, the topic is marginalized not just in Rawls, but in the vast secondary literature his work would generate over the next half century. Both Rawlsian and non-Rawlsian, and including theorists on the right of the liberal spectrum and the non-liberal communitarian tradition as well. So though I'd be focusing on liberalism in general and Rawls in particular, it's no longer an empty chair. So maybe someone will have to bring an empty chair up on stage for me. It needs to be appreciated that the pattern of neglect in the field is much broader. So the lecture is going to be in three sections. In part one, liberalism, I will begin by locating the seemingly puzzling failure within a much longer history of liberal political philosophy's betrayal of its ostensible ideals. In part two, doing injustice to justice, how Rawls went wrong, I will then turn specifically to Rawls and the ways in which his particular version of the liberal social justice project was flawed from the start. Finally, in part three, liberal racial justice, I will indicate, if only sketchily, one possible strategy for deriving liberal principles of racial justice via a modified version of the famous Rawlsian thought experiment. Okay, guys, so section one, illiberal liberalism. So our starting point is the political philosophy of liberalism, but I need to quickly clarify that I'm using the word as a term of art, the way political philosophers and political theorists do. So liberalism does not refer just to the left wing of the Democratic Party, which we saw in action just last night. Rather, its reference is the political ideology that develops over the 17th to 19th centuries in Western Europe in opposition to the doctrines of monarchical absolutism, natural social estates, ascriptive social hierarchy, and inherited status. Associated with John Locke, Adam Smith, Thomas Paine, Thomas Jefferson, Immanuel Kant, Jeremy Bentham, John Stuart Mill, and others, liberalism becomes the philosophy of the new social order, indeed of modernity itself. The rule of law, limited government, democratic consent, individual equality, equal rights, all become the slogans of the revolt against the Ancien Régime. Hence the American Revolution's famous opening statement of the Declaration, penned by Jefferson, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. And the liberty, equality, fraternity of the French Revolution. Being a liberal commits you to these broad principles. So from this perspective, we have liberals on the right who insist on market solutions and liberals on the left who argue for a state that intervenes on behalf of the disadvantaged, but by these minimal criteria, both groups count as liberals. Hence, conservatives' characterization of themselves sometimes as classical liberals. So we're the real liberals, you guys have usurped the title, you're really socialist. So liberalism can then be seen as the most important political ideology of the last few hundred years. The ideology that, especially after the 1989-1991 collapse of the East Bloc, had seemingly emerged triumphant over all its challenges. As I don't have to tell you, the celebratory moment was pretty brief. We're now in a period when liberalism is under assault by right-wing populism and authoritarian ethno-nationalism, and there are no guarantees we'll be the eventual victim. But certainly we have to hope that liberalism will survive and eventually prevail, given the attractiveness of its ideals and the corresponding ugliness of those of its opponents. So in the official story then, liberalism has historically faced foes both on the right and on the left, and has historically maintained a principled opposition to reactionary pre-modern ideologies, ideologies that denied people individual status and equal rights and entitlement to government by consent. It's a great story, an inspiring story, but the problem is it happens to be untrue. Or at least the extent to which it is true is severely qualified. Far from being in principled combat from the start against anti-egalitarian beliefs and systems of ascriptive hierarchy, liberalism has been complicit with many of them until comparatively recently, and some critics would say it is in effect, if no longer overtly, still thus complicit today. Liberalism as ideal turns out to be illiberalism in actuality. Consider, for example, gender. From the first wave of feminism onward, for example, the British Mary Wollstonecraft's A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, the French Olympe de Gouges' Rights of Women, the US's own Abigail Adams, from the first wave, feminist theorists have pointed out that the promise of liberalism was not extended to women, a challenge that would, of course, be greatly deepened and expanded in the second wave and later waves. Denied equal rights, unable to own property or run for political office or even vote, their legal identities subsumed into their husbands under the doctrine of coverture, women are clearly not ranked among the free and equal individuals liberated by this new political philosophy of government by consent. Rather, their status seems to be a kind of gender estate analogous to those, subordinated in the feudal hierarchy. But women of all races constitute half the population to begin with. This is not a minor exclusion, but a huge one. Then think of race. Though this history is now marginalized in the official liberal story, we need to remember that most of the Western European states, now uncontroversially considered part of the liberal West, at one time or another had empires, British, French, Dutch, Spanish, Portuguese, Belgian, in which non-Europeans, indigenous peoples, and in some cases African slaves, were systemically subordinated. Together, these Western countries ruled undemocratically over the vast majority of humanity. Indeed, this global racial inequality was so firmly entrenched as a norm, so taken for granted. I've given this historical episode at numerous talks I've given, I sometimes ask the audience, how many of you have heard of this? And usually it's very few hands that grow. 1919, so a bit more than a century ago, we're in the post-World War I Versailles Conference in Paris to set up the League of Nations. Just had this horrible war, the Great War, want to make sure this never happens again. But we all know how successful they were at that. Most of the world is colonized. Most of the world is under the rule of the European powers. One of the few independent nations of color is Japan. The Japanese delegation says, hey, we need a racial equality clause in the covenant of the League of Nations so as to make sure that we have a world that's racially equitable. Nothing controversial about equality. After all, as I just said earlier, equality is supposed to be one of the watchwords of liberal modernity. And we are now deep into liberal modernity. I mean, for God's sake, it's the 20th century. And this proposal by the Japanese was unequivocally rejected by the six Anglo-Saxon nations, as they were then called. And who, you might ask, were they? Britain, the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa. So let me ask you guys, how many of you have ever heard of this historical episode? A handful. This in a prestigious, very well-known university of Michigan and has not been part of your education. And you need to ask yourself why that is, what that says about the educational system that you know you were inculcated with, and what that says about the sort of broader history of imperialism and colonialism that has now been covered up. Anyway, so you know, that's gender, that's race. Think now of class. Though modernity is surely supposed, at the very least, to equalize status hierarchies among white males, even here, the process is very uneven. The birth of liberalism may date to the 17th century, but property restrictions on the franchise in many European countries remain in place to the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And in the US, it's really only with 19th century Jacksonian democracy that you get universal suffrage, even among white men. So the point is then that once we put together all the exclusions of actual historical liberalism, we should be able to see that a conceptualization that represents them as anomalies and deviations is fundamentally wrong. The dominant varieties of historical liberalism excluded the majority of the world's population from equal normative consideration. But if exclusion is modal, if propertied white males are the major beneficiaries of modernity's liberalization, then how can the conventional narrative of a clear transition from the world of hierarchical estates to a world of equal individuals be sustained? Doesn't our periodization, doesn't our conceptual map and our temporal map need to be changed? And happily for you, you don't have to do this yourself, because on this very useful handout, if you can see it in this dark room, I thought it would be a bit light in here, I have provided for you a neat diagram which you can put on your, I don't know, your bathroom wall, your refrigerator door, the place where you do your heavy thinking. So the top indicates the conventional story. So the conventional periodization is illiberalism versus liberalism. So illiberalism is pre-modern, inegalitarian political ideologies, such as you'd find in ancient Greece and Rome, such as you'd find in the Middle Ages. Those are the bad old days when your people were in these sort of hierarchical social orders, citizens and slaves in ancient Greece and Rome, lords and serfs in the Middle Ages. But thank God that's all over. We're now in the modern period. We've put all that behind. We're now in the world of individuals. So that's a just so story, that's a fairest story that you tell your kids, or alas, perhaps that you tell your students. Maybe you guys, some of you guys right here in this room have heard the story. So the bottom diagram, the revisionist periodization, gives you the more accurate story. So in that story, we should sort of see it as illiberalism part one, and then illiberalism part two, and illiberalism part two is for some reason known as liberalism. So in liberalism part one, we have the hierarchies I mentioned, and also gender hierarchies, which at least until recently were not part of the story. But as feminists have pointed out, you can see women as constituting a kind of subordinate gender estate. So citizens and slaves in ancient Greece and Rome, and men and women, medieval period, lords and serfs, and again, men and women. And then in the modern period, lo and behold, we continue to have these hierarchies, men and women still, as a sort of, you know, enduring constant. There's also the property and non-property insofar as the restriction on the franchise and stuff like that. And we have the new category of whites over people of color. So by the conventional dating, you don't have race in the pre-modern period. It's only in modernity that race comes into existence. So the point is then that with this reconceptualization, we would re-theorize liberalism to emphasize its continuity with the past rather than its putative, sharp break from it. And we would then start to look at liberalism very differently with, shall we say, a far more suspicious and critical eye. So rather than automatically presuming that liberalism is going to be adequate to dealing with a particular social problem facing us, we would begin by asking ourselves the question, if liberalism has been illiberalism along so many crucial axes of social subordination, how has this pernicious shaping by group domination affected its crucial concepts, norms, frameworks, and assumptions? What silences, what opacities, what inadequacies might we expect to find in liberalism given this history? Indeed, isn't it likely to be the case that where class, gender, and race are involved, the inclusion of groups previously formally excluded is going to be merely nominal unless the deep structuring of liberalism as a theory by its previous history is acknowledged and expressly addressed? So one can readily appreciate then why, given this history, some radical political thinkers have given up on liberalism together, and has also given up on people like Charles Mills, who still insists that liberalism can be retrieved. So now there's a bunch of folks who cross the street when they see me coming. What can I say, guys? I hope you won't join their company, because I'm going to sort of defend here a radical liberalism. And not to plug my recent book, but that's what these occasions are in part four, right? So my recent book, Black Rights, White Wrongs, one of the themes of the book is black radical liberalism. So if this sounds oxymoronic, you know, buy the book, available at all better bookstores. Oh, they don't exist. Available at Amazon, and you sort of, you know, get my attempt to sort of combine radical theory with liberalism. Okay, so anyway, how can you retrieve liberalism given this sordid history and given these critiques? My claim is that rather than, you know, sort of brushing all this stuff, you know, under the carpet, to liberalize illiberal liberalism, we need to do several things. Number one, rewrite the history of liberalism so its exclusions are highlighted rather than marginalized. Number two, make clear rather than obfuscate the role of the canonical liberal theorists in justifying these exclusions. Number three, place at center stage rather than off stage the concrete shaping by group privilege of the crucial components of liberalism. And then number four, self-consciously reconceive all of these to achieve genuine liberal justice. So my claim is that if you make these moves, you can get a liberalism that's quite different from the ones that we're accustomed to, the liberalism that, as I say, has been complicit with these systems of ascriptive hierarchy that was supposed to be eliminated by the transition to the modern period. Okay, so on that basis then, I suggest that we sort of look at the components of liberalism, and I come up with what I see as a list. So this is on page two of the handout, of crucial components. A character set of value commitments, that's, you know, moral equality, freedom, and self-realization. B, a certain social ontology. If you're a member of the American Philosophical Association and you don't use the word ontology in a talk, there's somebody at the APA sitting at the back row and your membership card will be yanked. So you always have to make sure that ontology is in there. Okay, so whoever it is, I've put ontology in there. So B, a certain social ontology. C, a conceptual cartography of the socio-political. D, an account of the history that has led up to the present. And C, a schedule of rights, protections, and freedoms. So value commitment, that should be straightforward. Social ontology, what do I mean? How do we think of people in liberal political philosophy? And liberalism is traditionally thought of as has an ontology of atomic individuals. And I would claim that this conventional representation is actually false, because there are liberal theorists, and Derek Darby, my colleague in the sense of, you know, black philosophers, my colleague has pointed out that there's a tradition of T.H. Green and the British Hegelians, and they had a liberalism that was social. Or if you look at, you know, the United States, John Dewey's liberalism was very much a social one. And what I would argue, and people like Elizabeth Anderson have argued for this, there's no inconsistency in saying that in a society based on domination, we need a social ontology that registers the fact of domination. So we can't assume that everybody is effectively equal if some position, people are positioned above others. So you need a social ontology that registers the fact of group domination, whether men over women, whites over people of color, or what. C, conceptual cartography, what do I mean? Well, think of, you know, the second wave feminist critique that the way the polity is drawn, the way the public-private boundary is drawn, is that, you know, the distinctive problems of women are basically not allowed to enter into the public sphere. So the family, patriarchal relations, sex, all of that is part of the private sphere. That's not a matter of justice. So what, you know, second wave feminists sort of set themselves to do is to argue for the redrawing of that map. So the conceptual cartography, how we draw the polity, that matters. D, the history. What I mean there is that to consider issues of, you know, how the society came into being, issues perhaps of corrective justice, we need to know what the actual history is. And part of the problem with actual liberal theory is that it obfuscates, it covers up, it whitewashes the history. The history, which, as I sort of mentioned briefly earlier, has been a history of racial subordination. So all of those put together, if you rewrite them, you rewrite the ontology, you remap the cartography, you give a different account of the history, it then means that to sort of bring about equality, freedom, and self-realization for individuals, you could end up with principles which seem quite different from liberal principles, but they're still liberal, but this is a liberalism that is now taking the history of the society and the actual structure of the society into account in a way that mainstream liberalism has not. So on the axis of class, going back to the 19th century, you have a social democratic version of liberal theory, which says liberals' principles are okay, but you need to sort of face the fact that the working class is going to be materially subordinated unless you sort of take account of the differential power that capital has. I don't have to tell you, we're now in an epoch, 1% versus 99%, the rise of plutocracy, as it has been called, the third Gilded Age. There was Mark Twain's Gilded Age in the 19th century. There was the 1920s, also known as the Jazz Age. We're now in the third Gilded Age, and people like Thomas Piketty have argued this may be the longest lasting one of all. So the inequalities of wealth in the United States and other countries are sort of as large as they've ever been. So there's a social democratic critique, well established. The gender critique, the feminist critique again, you need to sort of recognize the extent to which, you know, men are dominant over women, and this, you know, patriarchal domination manifests itself in all kinds of spheres. And of course, we've had several decades of feminist theory laying out a very plausible case to this effect. But the point I would make is that, unfortunately, the racial critique has not been as well developed as these other critiques. So that what I'm arguing for, that we need to do, is develop a racial critique of liberal theory that is going to be comparable in its significance and, you know, for the importance of rewriting mainstream political philosophy and mainstream political theory as, you know, social democratic liberal theory and feminist liberal theory have been. Okay, let me now talk briefly about what I'm going to call a liberalism that's racial. And the term here is unfortunately a bit confusing in that if in the 1950s somebody said you were racial liberal, it meant you were somebody who thought you should support black civil rights, you should oppose segregation. In other words, you're a good guy. You know, we want people to be racial liberals. Had I known that the term was so solidly entrenched in this previous usage, I might not have employed it. Anyway, I'm trying to demarcate a separate usage. And racial liberalism, as I use the term, is basically a liberalism that has been shaped by racial domination. So think of racial liberalism as analogous to what feminists would see as a patriarchal form of liberal theory, where liberalism has been shaped by its evolution in societies of male domination. So it then means that crucial terms, crucial frameworks, crucial values have all been permeated by the fact of male domination and the need to justify the subordination of half of the human race. And I'm arguing for a racial liberalism that's comparable to a patriarchal liberalism and that evolves in the period of European expansionism when key liberal theorists are completely on board with this program, so that Europeans basically expand into the world and you cannot then apply liberal theories equally to people of color as you can to Europeans, because then obviously it would mean that the processes in which you're involved, conquest of peoples, expropriation, racial slavery, these are all inconsistent with a liberalism that, you know, is color inclusive. So it has to be a liberalism that's racial restrictive. So you get a liberalism that's racialized. So it's a racial liberalism in that sense, in that crucial terms of the liberal theory are rewritten by race, so that the privileging of Europeans at the expense of people of color does not seem like an inconsistent. Does not seem like an inconsistency because people of color are not seen as moral equals. So you then get the world that I described in the Versailles Conference, where the Japanese proposal is shot down because, you know, the Anglo-Saxon nations are basically saying, look, the colonial world rests on racial inequality. This principle would upend this world, so clearly we cannot have that as part of the covenant of the League of Nations. Okay, so the crucial question then is, given that liberalism has been racialized, why is it there has not been more discussion within political theory and political philosophy of this fact? Why has this not been a sort of self-conscious project to sort of explore and investigate the racialization of liberalism and then to sort of make the theoretical moves necessary to de-racialize it? And my argument here, and some people have objected to this, but tell me what you think. My argument here is that one major factor is the demographic whiteness of the profession. So this will come as no news to the philosophers in the room, to the non-philosophers. Let me break the news to you. As I don't have to tell you, people of color are underrepresented in the academy in general. In philosophy, it's so extreme that basically, if you go to a meeting in the American Philosophical Association, you have to put on dark glasses. Otherwise, you might get snow blindness from the sort of an expanse of white faces. The percentage of black people in philosophy, I'm not making this up. It sounds like I am, but I'm not. The percentage of black philosophers in philosophy is 1%. It was 1% 20 years ago. It's still 1% today. Latinos, maybe another 1% Asian Americans, another 1% Native Americans, basically fingers of two hands. It's about 3% people of color. Very white profession. And the demographic whiteness, I would argue, basically helps to sustain a conceptual whiteness. And this term might seem more controversial, but the demographic whiteness is just a matter of numbers. You know, hard to disagree with that. The conceptual whiteness you have to make more of a case for, because many white philosophers get their backs up and they say, look, philosophy can't be white because philosophy is dealing with the human condition. People of color are human. You're certainly not denying that. Therefore, you know, you guys are automatically included in the sort of, you know, general and abstract representations that we're giving you as philosophers. And the problem with the argument, which feminist philosophers have sort of also made the case, you know, for the maleness of philosophy, is that the distinctive experiences of people of color are not really accommodated within these seemingly general and all-inclusive abstractions. So as I just mentioned, the experience of people of color in modernity is an experience of colonization, imperialist subordination, expropriation, racial slavery, apartheid, Jim Crow. To what extent are these experiences really part of the standard political story we hear in political philosophy? And I would argue they're almost completely marginal. So the question then is, what can be done about this? Well, before I move to that, which of course is the climax of the whole thing, let me make some comments about John Rawls. Okay, so that's another one, but I brought the chair, still not, okay. So pretend he's sitting there. So Clint Eastwood, the Academy Awards, I'm talking to John Rawls. Professor Rawls, who I should emphasize I never met, and I should also emphasize that everybody I've known who has met him speaks very highly of him, and tomorrow you'll hear from two of his students, so it should be emphasized that I'm not talking about how I've had bad experience with Rawls, I'm just talking about Rawls as a representative of a particular group in a particular time period, positioned in such a way that certain problems are not addressed. So it seems to focus on Rawls, but I'm really talking about an entire cohort of white mainstream political theorists. Okay, so Rawls's 1971 book, A Theory of Justice, is generally seen by many people as the most important book in political philosophy of the 20th century. Well, certainly the most American book in political philosophy of the 20th century, but some people go further, the most important book of global political philosophy of the 20th century. And this book accomplishes several things. It revives social contract theory. Social contract theory had its heyday in the century and a half, from 1650 to 1800. So Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Immanuel Kant. And then it goes into historical decline. It's displaced by more historically oriented theories like Hegel and later Marx, and by utilitarian theory. And you know, by the mid-50s or so, social contract theory is seen as dead, and also Anglo-American political philosophy is seen as moribund. You know, if you go back to the period, you find articles written, you know, sort of warning about the survival of Anglo-American political philosophy. And the subject matter was seen as so boring that it's not merely that the people reading the articles tended to fall asleep. Even the people writing the articles tended to fall asleep. You know, you're there, so What was I writing again? Oh, right. So political philosophy had been reduced to boring stuff like linguistic analysis, how should we think of obligation, and so forth. And Rawls's work revitalizes the field. And suddenly people are doing all kinds of exciting stuff. They're talking about, you know, the big picture, the grand theory, and so forth. And one of the crucial things that Rawls does, he revives social contract theory, and he says the appropriate theme of social contract theory should be social justice. And here's what Rawls does. He revives social contract theory in the form of a thought experiment. As I mentioned to you guys, I switched from physics because, you know, my real-life experiments in the lab, they never came out. But thought experiment, that was a whole different story. So here's the Rawls on thought experiment. You're going to be choosing principles of justice for a society. And you're choosing them not on principled moral grounds, but on selfish grounds, prudential grounds. What's in it for me? And you might think that's a really bad basis for choosing principles of justice. But you haven't heard the whole story. Because Rawls specifies you're choosing behind a veil of ignorance. So you don't know crucial facts about yourself. You don't know crucial facts about the society. So it means that the combination of self-interest and this stipulated ignorance is going to result in the equivalent of a moral choice. And Rawls also allows for us to sort of move out from behind the veil and check what these principles, whether or not they comport with or sort of deepest, you know, moral principles. So there's sort of check of that kind. So you're not going to choose a sexist society because for all you know, you may turn out to be female. You're not going to choose a racist society because for all you know, you may turn out to be white. Not, of course, that there can't be other kinds of racist societies. You're not going to choose a plutocratic society because you don't know where they're going to be in the privileged socioeconomic class. So Rawls says these are a good way for generating principles of justice. And the principles he came up with, I have written down for you, so I hope you have your handouts with you, in the form of a neat formula that I originally devised to sort of help my students to remember what the principles were, and they're BLFEORDP. And what that stands for is principles of distributive justice for an ideal society. Because the crucial point about Rawls is that he said our focus should be devising principles of justice for an ideal, that's a perfect society, a well-ordered society. So there are two principles of justice. The first principle, BL, those are the basic rights and liberties people should have. For example, to vote, to run for office, freedom of speech, liberty of conscience, right to hold personal property, all that good stuff. Second principle has two components, FEO, fair equality of opportunity. That's a combination of formal equality of opportunity, so you know, people are not discriminated against when they apply for jobs and so forth, but in addition, resources sort of equalize for class disadvantage. So the idea would be, if you're a working class kid as against an upper class kid, you should not be disadvantaged by that class background. We want you to have an equal shot at it for people who are, you know, sort of equally able. And then find the difference principle, that's for people who are disadvantaged by other things. For example, you have a thin bundle of natural talents. Rawls is a guy who believes there's a sort of definite sort of distribution curve of talents. Okay, so Rawls's book would generate a huge body of secondary literature. But here's the problem. He had very little to say about corrective justice. These are principles of distributive justice for an ideal society, a perfect society. And racial justice, my theme for this evening, is largely a matter of corrective justice in societies that are unjust. So in my work in the previous years, I've spent a fair amount of time criticizing Rawls and Rawlsians and saying, look, you guys claim to be concerned about justice, and yet you're not talking about racial justice. We need to sort of ask the question about how we can make the transition from Rawls's principles of ideal justice for a well-ordered society to societies that are not well-ordered. We need to talk about corrective justice. And then about 2 years ago, I had a theoretical epiphany. So there are religious epiphanies, there are, you know, all kinds of epiphanies, there are personal epiphanies. This was a theoretical epiphany. And I came to believe that actually I had been misinterpreting Rawls all along. And what that implied is that a significant amount of my previous criticisms of Rawls had been unjustified. But you'll be glad to hear, lest you think it's going to sort of Rawls love fest, that it meant that a whole new wave of criticisms could now be unleashed. So I'm going to give you the background to sort of explain this. And I have a claim that I've put in bold. I don't know whether you can see it in this room. But here's my dramatic claim, put in bold. Rawls's theory of justice does not apply to the United States. Let me say that again, because it's so bizarre. Rawls's theory of justice does not apply to the United States. So obviously you're going to ask, why on earth would Rawls, a citizen of the United States, have devised a theory of justice that was not applicable to his own country? But I'm not saying he intended it not to apply. Rather, what I'm claiming is that as a matter of fact, it doesn't apply. So in analytic philosophy, it's standardly accused of having physics envy. I switched from physics into philosophy, not realizing I was not getting away from physics. Anyway, so part of the physics envy manifests itself in the use of, diagrams and subscripts and letters and so forth. So again, it sort of keep my APA membership. I've done my small bit towards this end. So once more, if you consult your handout, you will see my original interpretation and now my revised interpretation. So my original interpretation, and I'm suggesting that the first three premises of this are widely shared in the profession. It is important to fay. We should be trying to fay. Rawls is trying to fay. Rawls is doing a bad job of faying. Bad Rawls, bad. So Rawls should be criticized for doing a bad job of faying, and in fact, that's what I've been doing for several years. How wrong I was. My recent revised interpretation, Rawls is not trying to fay in the first place. So Rawls cannot be criticized for faying badly. But it's important to fay. We should be trying to fay. So Rawls should be criticized for not even trying to fay in the first place. So the obvious question, the burning question that I know you all have on your lips is, well, gee, what is faying? And now to keep you in suspense, the answer is, faying is developing a theory of justice for modern Western societies of all kinds, both racist and non-racist. And why is Rawls not trying to fay? Because in his own mind, he doesn't have to. The class of racist modern Western societies is empty. No modern Western society is racist. Therefore, the United States is not racist. Now, that's a pretty strange set of claims. So let me now try to make them plausible for you. So I'm going to use the symbol TJ, R and not R. Rawls' theory of justice applies both to racist and non-racist Western societies. TJ, not R, Rawls' theory of justice only applies to non-racist Western societies. USA, not R, the US is not a racist society. USA, R, the US is a racist society. So let's go through these. And first of all, where's the evidence for this crucial claim I made, which is obviously quite crazy? My suggestion is that it's in his final book, Justice as Fairness. So this is the last book Rawls wrote, not quite finished because of his illness, edited by philosopher Aaron Kelly. And in this book, you can find the following two sentences, admittedly separated by some pages, but nonetheless, I think the link should be clear. Page 40, so this is John Rawls. Justice as fairness, so that's Rawls's theory, justice as fairness is a political conception of justice for the special case of the basic structure of a modern democratic society. And then a few pages later, page 21, he expands on this. From the start, then, we view a democratic society as a political society that excludes a confessional or an aristocratic state, not to mention a caste, slave, or racist one. So this was my epiphany. It's not that I was reading this book for the first time. The book has been out since 2001. But for some reason, the passages had never struck me before. So my inference is that Rawls is saying, look, my theory has a very limited scope. It doesn't apply to these other theories. We wouldn't think of them. Confessional, that's a theocratic state, aristocratic state, caste society, racist society included on that list. So the question then is, am I getting things wrong? Because you see, if I'm not getting things wrong, then the natural follow-up question is, how come nobody has noticed this before? As I say, this is not a new book. Just as Fairness came out in 2001. A lot of people read Rawls's work, so a lot of people have been reading these passages. So could it be that I've just misinterpreted these passages? So in this section, I tried to consider some objections to my theory, and doubtless Professor Freeman will have even more tomorrow that I have not thought of, unfortunately. and say why I don't think those objections work. Okay, objection number one. You, Charles Mills, are just confusing and misreading the familiar distinction Rawls makes between ideal theory, that's the theory of a perfectly just society, and non-ideal theory. So he's not saying anything new than, you know, what he's always said. Here's my response to that. If that were true, it would then mean that Rawls's theory of justice applies to all the other societies in that list. All you have to do is to switch to the non-ideal extrapolation of Rawls's theory. So that list includes, just to remind you, a confessional state, that's a theocratic state, an aristocratic state, a caste society, a slave society. But the problem with this is that everybody knows in the profession, who reads Rawls in political philosophy, that Rawls's work is marked by a shift in the early Rawls, the later Rawls, from what seems like an all-encompassing theory, a comprehensive liberal theory, to a political liberal theory. And he makes clear what he said was there in the early work, if badly phrased. His reference point is modern Western liberal democracies. So it's not the case that Rawls's theory is all applicable, that can be sort of, you know, you can apply it to all kinds of societies. It's limited to modern Western liberal societies. So my response here is a reductio of the claim that, you know, you can just switch to non-ideal theory and handle racist societies, because if that were true, that would go for the others also, and that goes against what we know and is well established in the secondary literature. That's not how Rawls meant his work to be read. So consider a second objection. The second objection now is, okay, maybe you're right, but it's an isolated element of his what he says. In other words, Rawls was sick, it's an isolated conceptual gaffe, and you know, had he had the time to sort of do a proper revision of his work, it's something he would have cleared up. So it might be true, he might have said it, but it's not really something that's related to the rest of his work. And I suggest that, far from this being true, it follows directly from the characterization he gives from the very opening pages of A Theory of Justice. And part of the problem is that these pages have not been as read as thoroughly as they should have been, despite the fact that they're at the start of the book. I mean, you can sort of start to skip and skim later on the book, but surely not in the opening pages. So everybody who reads Rawls will have read those pages. And what does he say in those pages? What he says explicitly is that society is, and here I quote, a cooperative venture for mutual advantage, governed by rules designed to advance the good of those taking part in it. He's not given us a definition of an ideal, well-ordered society. That doesn't come until the next paragraph. He's telling us what a society is. So Rawls is basically defining society in such a way that only societies of equity and cooperation and reciprocal benefit count as societies. And that's kind of crazy. And it's also inconsistent with what we just heard, where he does concede the existence of theocratic societies, slave societies, aristocratic societies, and so forth. So I think the most charitable reading of, you know, this characterization of societies and a theory of justice is that Rawls is telling us, these are the societies to which my theory of justice applies. So there's a range of possible societies, you know, all kinds of different societies, obvious throughout human history. These are the societies to which my theory applies. And what I think gives plausibility to my interpretation is that, remember, Rawls not merely revives Anglo-American political philosophy, but he revives social contract theory. And the key idea of social contract theory is that we should think of society as having been formed by people in a pre-social and pre-political condition coming together to say, let's create a society, let's create a political order, and let's make sure that, you know, we don't lose out the advantages we have by being in a pre-social and pre-political state, so-called state of nature. In the state of nature, you have all kinds of freedoms, but there's a danger, especially in a theorist like Hobbes, you're going to be ripped off. So we want the state to protect us, we want to sort of give up some freedoms and sort of have others safeguarded. But the crucial point is that it's a consensual process, and what you're going to establish is a society and a political system that benefits everybody. So once you think of it that way, you see that he's telling us from the start, my theory has a very limited application. My theory only applies to societies that can be modeled by the social contract metaphor. And unfortunately, given the unhappy history of humanity, that is a very, very small subset of the societies that exist in human history. In fact, you could go so far as to say that given the history of all kinds of oppression, gender oppression, ethnic oppression, religious oppression, colonial oppression, racial oppression, maybe it only applies to hunter-gatherer societies. That once you get class society emerging, once you get patriarchy emerging, once you get, you know, the early stages of colonialism, all these societies are going to be oppressive. Rawls's theory does not apply to them because none of these societies can be modeled by the social contract of being brought into existence in a consensual way with rules that are going to benefit everybody. So my suggestion is that far from this being any isolated conceptual gaffe, it's in fact tied directly to the specification he's given three decades earlier of the kind of societies to which his principles apply. And then finally, the third objection. Look, here's why you have to be wrong. Your implication would then be that Rawls could say nothing about race because, you know, you'd have a situation where you have a racist society, he's excluded it, but we know that Rawls does talk about race, not at any great length. There's scattered passages here and there. He cites Martin Luther King Jr., and in Justice as Fairness, his final book, he expresses his hope that liberal principles will be able to tackle issues of gender and racial injustice. So what you're saying, Mills, could not be true, because if Rawls did not expect his theory could extend to racist societies, he would not have said explicitly that I'm confident that the principles of the liberal tradition will be able to handle these issues. I've not done so myself. Nonetheless, I'm sure they can. And here's where I argue, this is part of my epiphany, here's where I argue we need to make a crucial distinction between societies with racism and societies that are racist. And my argument is going to be that Rawls thought of the US as a society with racism, but not a society that is racist. And to this end, I'm going to call your attention to this incomprehensible diagram that is occupying a full page in your handout. And my hope is that if you bear with me, I will make it comprehensible. So this large I at the left, I stands for ideal, because remember, Rawls's principles of justice are for ideal societies, what he calls well-ordered societies. That's what his principles are for. So on the left, you have ideal. And then as you move right, as you move away from the left, I didn't design it that way, folks, not to reveal my political sympathies, it's just the way left and right work out. As you move to the right, you move away from ideality, and the further you get over here, the further you are from an ideal society. So if you're here, you're almost perfect. It's an almost perfect society. Whereas if you're over here, you're in a deeply oppressive social system. So here's the point, an obvious point when you think about it, that has not been sufficiently paid attention to by political philosophers. The category of the non-ideal encompasses a huge range of societies. Because ideal in the literal sense means perfect, so the slightest deviation from perfection immediately precipitates you into the realm of the non-ideal. So societies that are just to the right of this big I, that are almost perfect, and societies way over here, are in the same category of the non-ideal. Now, clearly, that is a very crude category. That's a very undifferentiated category. It's not going to work for us. We need to make an internal distinction within the realm of the ideal. So this dotted line that I've indicated here is supposed to indicate the transition between societies that are basically pretty good overall. They're not perfect, but they're still pretty good. And then once you cross this dotted line, you get into the area of societies that are not merely non-ideal, but they're oppressive. Okay? So this box, society is non-ideal but non-oppressive, whereas everything over here from then on is non-ideal and oppressive. And my suggestion is that the social contract metaphor of a society as a cooperative venture of mutual advantage with reciprocally beneficial rules, that only applies to societies in what I'm calling the I zone, within the dotted area. So they're not perfect, but they're close enough that we can say, yeah, they're roughly societies that can be modeled by a contract. And once you pass the dotted line, once you're in this part of the diagram, the contract metaphor no longer applies. So the crucial question then is, for the issue of race, where does the United States fit? Okay, so that brings us to the sort of crucial question of how should we think of the United States historically? Is it merely a society with racism, or is it a society that is itself racist? Okay, so what I suggest is that though Rawls never went into this, and because mainstream political philosophers don't talk about race, you know, they had not been investigated by them either, what is the difference, what is the principal demarcation from a Rawlsian point of view between a society with racism and a society that is racist? And I suggest the principal demarcation is, does race affect in a deep and significant way the basic structure? It's a crucial concept for Rawls. He says justice, it applies to the basic structure, and that's what we should focus on. And the basic structure includes the main political and social institutions, so that's the Constitution, it's an independent judicial system, the legally recognized forms of property and the structure of the economy, the family. That's all in the basic structure. So the crucial question for us is, does race affect any of these in a way that's deep and significant? Because if it does, you then have a racialized basic structure. So let's consider the possibilities. So I have them sort of listed on the handout for you. Could it be that the United States was racist before Rawls's birth, but then ceased to be one by the time of his birth? Could it be that it was racist during his lifetime for part of it, but then ceased to be such? Could it be that it was racist during his lifetime, but after, no? So I can go through all of them, and I ask you to think of the following. And bear in mind, some of you, I'm sure, will have read the 1619 Project, people on the New York Times undertook, and their crucial point of how fundamentally slavery has shaped the United States and continues to do so 400 years later. And you may also have read of the controversy. There's some historians pushing back, but what's important to emphasize is that the pushback is on secondary issues. For example, the claim that they make that the revolution against the British was in part to protect slavery. So there's pushback on those claims, but the crucial claim on which there's pretty well agreement across the board is that slavery has deeply shaped the United States. Okay, so consider first of all the period before Rawls's birth. The US was a slave society. Rawls talks about legally recognized forms of property. This included property in human beings. And there's a famous historian of slavery, died a few years ago, Ira Berlin, celebrated as one of American slavery's leading historians. And he drew a famous distinction between, quote, societies with slaves, where slavery is institutionally siloed, it's sort of cabined, and then slave societies, where the peculiar institution, so-called in the US, pervades directly or indirectly the whole social order. So in effect, the entire society is peculiar. And for him, the United States was a prime example of the latter. So I'll quote here from Berlin. Slavery stood at the center of economic production, and the master-slave relationship provided the model for all social relations: husband and wife, parent and child, employer and employee, teacher and student, end quote. So the structure of the economy was the structure of a slave economy. So clearly there's no ambiguity there. During the period of slavery, there's no doubt at all that the basic structure, insofar as the economy is a crucial part of it, the basic structure is racialized. Well, what about the Constitution? Again, scholars of the Constitution have pointed out that, you know, you find slavery affecting how the Constitution is written, and there are all these clauses where slavery is not mentioned, but they're basically referring indirectly to the institution of slavery. And then even after the war, 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments, the Civil War Amendments, there's a question of how the Constitution is interpreted. So Rawls is giving us, in effect, a kind of naive picture. There's a Constitution, there's one set of interpretation, so we don't need to worry about the Constitution so. But how are the principles of the Constitution interpreted? So, for example, think of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. There's an Equal Protection Clause, so clearly that's going to rule out the institution of Jim Crow, because the system of separate but equal is clearly unfair to black Americans. Well, it didn't. That's the whole point. In the Plessy versus Ferguson decision of 1896, the Supreme Court ruled that you could, in fact, have separate but equal. And that's not overturned, of course, as we know, until the decision of Brown. So whatever the Constitution says, it's always subject to interpretation, which is why there's a debate between people who think we should go for original intent and people who think we should side with the idea of a living Constitution that evolves over time. So merely to point to attractive principles in the Constitution is not sufficient. The question is how these principles are interpreted. Okay, so the period before Rawls' birth, US was clearly a racist society during the period of slavery. What about the period of Jim Crow? Well, again, think about it. It's the period of the betrayal of Reconstruction, separate but equal, which is really separate and unequal, thousands of unpunished lynchings, the repeated defeat in Congress of attempted anti-lynching legislation, and in general, widespread discrimination, reducing blacks to the status of second-class members of the social system. A slave economy has been replaced by a Jim Crow economy, and a famous essay by the legal theorist Cheryl Harris suggests that whiteness effectively functions as property. So even if you don't have formal slavery, you have property in whiteness, and that means, again, that property relations are being affected by race. And here's a really stunning fact, a really ugly fact, but something that, again, people need to know. It's the 1930s. You're a young Nazi lawyer. You know, the Third Reich has been put in place. You're looking forward to a glorious thousand-year history. And you want to disenfranchise the Jewish population. You're looking for a juridical model for the Nuremberg Laws, the 1935 anti-Semitic Nuremberg Laws, which reduced Jews to second-class status. And if people will forgive a bit of national stereotype, and you're a German, you want to do things thoroughly and properly. So you look all around the world for a role model. And which society do you hit upon? Alas, it's the United States. Book came out in 2017, Hitler's model, Hitler's legal model, something like that. Jim Crow legislation in the United States was a model the Nazis used for the anti-Semitic Nuremberg laws. And people may be interested in who the runner-up was in sort of competition for the supreme racial state on the planet. The runner-up was the British Empire. So again, probably not part of the history you were taught in high school or even in university. This is a racial history, the centrality of race to make of the modern world, that people like myself, people in critical race theory, says we need to talk about it more because it's so crucial to understanding the world that we currently have. Okay, so clearly, you know, a period before Rawls's birth, you know, that was not a period, or you could say that the basic structure is not affected by race. So maybe it's in Rawls's lifetime. Maybe it's what was called the second Reconstruction. First Reconstruction didn't work out so well. We had, you know, the betrayal of Reconstruction. We had the withdrawal of federal troops. We had, you know, the rollback of voting rights. But the second Reconstruction, civil rights legislation of the 1950s and 60s, maybe that's a turning point. That from then on, you could say the US was not racist. But again, looking back from the perspective of 40, 50 years later, those of us who work on race know all the unhappy statistics, continuing residential segregation, continuing educational segregation, ongoing nationwide practice of de facto discrimination, new techniques of disenfranchisement, voter suppression, the wealth gap, the prison industrial complex, the pattern of police killings of unarmed black men and women. It's not really plausible to claim that the US has ceased to be a racist society. And finally, because discussions of the family, because the family is part of the basic structure for Rawls, discussions of the family in the Rawls and literature, because of the demography of the profession, have been overwhelmingly shaped by the interests of white feminist theory. If we look at the family from the perspective of Black woman, Latina woman, Native woman, then the family is also racialized as an institution. During slavery, obviously slave families were not recognized, and even free Black families were not seen as equal to the white ones. Dorothy Roberts, well-known Black feminist theorist, points out a long history of Black women and women of color being deprived of equal reproductive rights. If you think of anti-miscegenation law, if you think of the fact that in a liberal democracy, the Constitution allowed states to forbid people from being involved in interracial relations, interracial marriages, and that it took until 1967, the Supreme Court Loving versus Virginia decision, and that at one time or another, not at the same time, but at different times, at one time or another, no less than 41 states had anti-miscegenation legislation on their books. So that, as one theorist has pointed out, you could see anti-miscegenation law as a kind of factory for the production of race. So it means that by all these criteria, the economy, the polity, the legal system, the family, the basic structure has been racialized from the start. So if you use the criterion of the basic structure being affected by race in a deep and significant way, then the US is a racist society, and it then follows that Rawls's principles do not apply to the United States. So what are the implications of this? They're really very startling. To begin with, the obvious point, it means that if you're attempting to use this Rawls's work to do the, to basically theorize corrective racial justice, you can't. Because it means that corrective racial justice for Rawls would only be for societies within the I zone, within, you know, that sort of small space close to ideal societies. Societies that are outside the I zone, you need a different set of principles for them. So that's one obvious set of implications. But there's an even more startling set of implications. Even if you're not working on race, whatever you're working on, if you're trying to apply Rawls to the United States, whatever area you're working on, the implication of this, as I say, this epiphany I've had, is that you cannot do that either. Because Rawls's principles in general do not apply to the United States, whether you're working on race or not. So next year, 2021, 50th anniversary of Rawls's book, it would mean, if I'm right, that half a century of Rawls scholarship, insofar as that scholarship has sought to apply to the United States, half a century of Rawls' scholarship, Rawlsian scholarship, has basically been founded on a mistaken assumption. Okay, that's an hour and 6 minutes. Okay, so I have a whole section on how Rawls went wrong, and what I try to do there is try to reconstruct, you know, the particular social group of which Rawls was a member, and, you know, the sort of distinctive shortcomings, opacities, blind spots of this group. But because of time, I'm going to skip over this. But I'd recommend to everybody who's interested in these issues this, you know, very informative book by Katrina Forrester, young woman at Harvard. It's basically a history of ideas book rather than a philosophy book, but it gives this wonderful reconstruction of the particular milieu of, you know, the post-war scene, three crucial institutions, I think Harvard, Princeton, Oxford, and that's where egalitarian racial liberalism was founded, you know, in the work of those people. And, you know, the problem is that's a very limited group of people. It's not sort of looking outside their circles, and it's not raising questions that other people would have raised. And I just want to sort of point to one of them in particular. The standard narrative, as I say, is that Anglo-American political philosophy was moribund in the 50s and 60s until it was revived by Rawls. And in addition, Rawls made the innovative move of changing the subject of normative subject of political philosophy away from our obligation to the state to social justice. I'm going to suggest to you that that is another just so story which is false. And the reason is there's a long African-American political tradition which long predates Rawls, which goes back, you know, to the early revolutionary period, which certainly is represented in the 19th century, whose focus from the very start is racial justice. And there's a big book coming out, Melvin, Melvin Rogers at Brown Political Theatre, Brown, and Chip, that's his nickname. One of those senior moments. Anyway, it's coming out. I green lighted the University of Chicago Press. So it's going to be this huge book, basically looking each chapter a particular African American political theorist. And my hope is, and certainly the editor's hope is, that this will become a sort of, you know, standard text showing, look, there's this sort of long, important African American tradition, and it needs to be engaged with by mainstream Euro-American political theory. And that's going to include Euro-American political philosophy and Euro-American discussions of justice. Because as I say, what comes sort of completely clearly if you read this book is that social justice has been a theme for the start for these folks, racial justice has been a theme, and these people are Anglo-American. I mean, they're English-speaking, they're citizens of the United States. You know, what could be so more appropriately Anglo-American than that? So one of the things that we need to do in terms of, in a sort of making philosophy more representative, is to recognize that there's a long history of discussions of justice and this very sort of narrow genealogy that mainstream white political philosophers have given us is really utterly misleading. Okay, last section, liberal racial justice. How much time do I have? Could an organizer point me and tell me how much time I have? No organizer is willing to do so. There's a danger I will go on and on and on. How much? Okay, I'll go for another 10 minutes. Okay, so if I'm right that the Rawlsian literature cannot handle race, not merely contingently that they've chosen not to do so, but if this epiphany is correct, and it turns out the apparatus was not designed for it and was never meant by Rawls to be designed for it because it only applies to societies with non-racialized basic structures, says within the I zone. So what can one do? My suggestion is that what we do is turn to a different modeling of society and a different contract. And here, surprise, surprise, I'm going to put in a plug for my own earlier work. And there's a well-known political theorist, Carl Pateman, wrote a book in 1988, The Sexual Contract, and I was inspired by Carl's book to write my first book, The Racial Contract, and we also did a book together, Contract and Domination. And in the latter book, Contract and Domination, we had separate chapters because we disagreed on various things. I argued that you could transform the contract model following her work and following the even earlier work of Jean-Jacques Rousseau in Discourse on the Origin of Inequality, you could use the contract to model domination. So in Rousseau's Discourse on the Origin of Inequality, he basically says contract theory is a scam. Contract theory is a scam insofar as he sort of tells the sort of history of society, people in the state of nature. Then society, there's an early stage which is very egalitarian, and then private property develops, divisions between rich and poor sharpen, the wealthy become worried about the threat to their property. So it's if you're into conspiracy theories, as many people on the left are, it's a great example in political philosophy of conspiracy theory. The wealthy get together and say, hey, let's come up with a set of norms and principles that are going to supposedly protect everybody's rights, and everybody will sort of sign up for it. But in reality, plutocracy will be basically embedded behind the scenes. So you can see that, I'm suggesting, as an early statement of the class contract. So Rousseau, the class contract, Pateman, sexual contract, then Mills, the racial contract. You can see I'm trying to sort of link myself to the great white tradition and thereby make myself respectable. So my argument is that if you think a kind of extrapolation of these three, a sort of abstract representation, it's the idea of a domination contract. The domination contract is not inclusive. It's basically for a group of the privileged to sort of recognize themselves as equal and basically see other people as unequal and then structure society and the polity and the economy around that. So I suggest that to do racial justice in a social contract framework, we need to shift from the consensual contract to the domination contract. And the domination contract is not, of course, to be endorsed by us. Rather, we need to ask ourselves, how do we dismantle it? So in the case of gender, it's a sexual contract. In the case of race, it's a racial contract. So here's my revision of the Rawlsian thought experiment. You are once again behind Rawls's veil of ignorance, but the experiment is set up in a different way. Rawls's principles are principles for an ideally just society. You're going to be looking for principles for an unjust society. So we're going to say, when the veil lifts, you're going to find yourself in a white supremacist society. And the question you need to ask yourself is, what race will I turn out to be? So once again, as with the Rawlsian original, you're using self-interest as a motivator, combining it with ignorance, and out of that combination, we're hoping to get a principled judgment which can stand up by moral criteria. So the idea would be, as a white person, you ask yourself, okay, I'm doing this thought experiment. Suppose the veil lifts, and let's say I'm a black woman in a ghetto in Southside Chicago. Or let's say I'm a Latina somewhere in the southwestern United States. Or I'm a Native American on the reservation. What principles of justice, what particular structure of public policy would I want to see put in place so as to make sure, as seriously as I can, that I'm not going to be radically handicapped in the social system. And the idea would be that by carrying out this thought experiment, you then force everybody who's doing it in good faith to sort of have the subject of racial justice center stage rather than off stage altogether, which for the most part it is in the mainstream social justice work. And what I've argued elsewhere is that you'd come up with three principles of corrective racial justice. One, end second-class civic status. I mean, historically, people of color have been seen as, you know, second-class or even sort of low. Two, end racial exploitation. And three, end racial disrespect. And I suggest that these principles are not merely what we choose on prudential grounds behind the veil, but that they comport with our moral intuitions outside the veil. Now, these are principles that are morally defensible principles. But that these principles that might seem on the face of it to be sort of innocuous, mom and apple pie, who could disagree, so what, would really have their radical implications. Because, for example, ending second-class status would mean, for example, things like revoking the Shelby decision. It would mean like dismantling the ghetto. It would mean radical revision of the prison industrial complex, ending racial exploitation. We'd have to sort of look at the question of what have been the processes in terms of mortgage discrimination, in terms of the racial implementation of the GI Bill after World War II, in terms of discrimination, all those sort of a huge set of economic processes, the kinds of things that Coates spoke about in his famous Atlantic article. You can then make a case for reparation on those grounds. And finally, racial disrespect. What I'm talking about here, situation where historically people of color have not been seen as moral equals, so that a racial contempt has suffused the society, leading to expressive harms. And of course, if you look at the literature, Black American, Latin, Native literature, this has been a sort of constant theme. We're not seen as equal human beings. So that what you then need to do is, what would you have to do in terms of, you know, public expressions of respect to sort of, you know, take account of that past? So there are things we've seen already in terms of, you know, civil war stature and monuments, using Native Americans as mascots, rewritings of textbooks to sort of, you know, talk about the contributions of people of color. But it would mean a sort of global reconstitution of the United States. And, you know, it would seem like a very radical one and maybe even seem like a non-liberal one. But the final point I want to drive home is, it's non-liberal by the standards of a liberalism that has been racialized. And what I've tried to make a case for is that for a liberalism that takes the history of racial subordination seriously, it is not non-liberal at all. So for anybody in this room who thinks of themselves as a good liberal, with a good liberal on the left or on the right, my claim is, outrageous as it may seem, you should be completely on board with this program. Thank you.